outside of the Mishnah. So the
Am I Braitovitz, February 19th, Thursday, first lesson in Tanya.
Now, if you ever read a page of Talmud, you will see that when the Gemara explains Mishnahs, one of the primary sources it uses to explain the Mishnah is a Braisa. The Braisa will often have a lot of supplementary information that will explain Mishnahs. So on one hand, it is not as authoritative as the Mishnah. On the other hand, it is probably the single most important interpretive tool that the Talmud uses to explain the Mishnah. Now, when you read Gemara, and the Gemara quotes from these different sources, there are certain code words that it uses. When it says Tanan, that always means we learnt in a Mishnah. When it says Tanya, it means we learnt in a Braisa. So Tanya means nothing more than we learned in a Braisa. So what type of title for a book is it? We learnt in a Braisa. It's not a title. It happens to be, just like we call the Parsha of the week, typically out of the first word, right? Parshas Bereishis is called Bereishis because the first word of the Parsha is Bereishis. Actually, this week is an exception. This is called Parshas Mishpatim. Mishpatim is actually word number two. The first word is Ela. But Ela is such a generic word, these, so we don't give it a title. So Tanya is not the name of the book at all. Tanya is just the first word of the book. The actual, so it became known as the Tanya. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who wrote the book, is often called the Baal HaTanya, the author of the Tanya. He's also called the Alter Rebbe, the old rabbi, because he was the first of the Chabad Rebbes. Or in Hebrew, it's called Admor HaZaken. What is Admor? Admor is an abbreviation. Adoneinu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu, our master, rabbi, and teacher. So Hasidic rabbis, great Hasidic rabbis, are called Admor. So the Alter Rebbe in Hebrew is called Admor HaZaken, Baal HaTanya, etc. So the Baal HaTanya actually called his book by two other titles. And you can even see this if you have a Tanya. The first title he gave his book is called Likutei Amarim. Likutei Amarim means an anthology of sayings. And this is a very modest title because the Alter Rebbe said, I'm not saying anything new in this book. I am simply gathering the various statements in the Talmud, the Medrash, the Zohar, and just giving you an anthology of statements. Now, that is absolutely not the case. There is much that is original and creative here. But in his modesty, and perhaps that people shouldn't attack him, because if you say something new, you're always in trouble. In his modesty, he simply called his book an anthology of sayings, Likutei Amarim. That's the first title that he gave. The second title he gave is a bit more subtle. He called it Sifran Shel Beinonim, the book for the middle of the road folk. What does that mean? Chazal say, the Rambam says, there are three categories of Jews. Tzadikim, the perfectly righteous. Rishaim, the perfectly evil. And then there's middle of the road. Now, Maimonides gives these very extreme definitions. An unusual. According to Maimonides, if you have more good deeds than bad deeds, 51 to 49, you're already called a tzaddik. If you're 51 to 49 in the negative, you're called a rasha. A beinoni is 50-50. Now, Maimonides makes the point that certainly we're not dealing with a crude, primitive, numerical weighing, because God does assign qualitative weights to different averos and different mitzvahs. So one mitzvah may count for 1,000, you know, etc. But ultimately, it's that type of weighing. Now, the big problem with Maimonides' definition is that that type of characterization changes a person from second to second, minute to minute. I mean, at 10 o'clock, let's assume I'm 51-49 for mitzvahs. So at 10 o'clock, I'm a tzaddik. I then yell at my wife when I get home because the toast was burnt. So at that point, that counts for 5 demerits. So now I'm a rasha. At 10:15, you know, I learn with my son, and you know, I give up my time, etc. In other words, it's kind of a crazy thing to say when you're. And who's going to be 50-50 anyway? You know, 50-50. How likely is that going to be? So because of this, the Bala Tanya fundamentally has a very different orientation, which is actually profoundly logical as well. And he says, a Beinoni does not mean you're 50-50, but it means you live in the realm of struggle. The tzaddik is the person who somehow made it. And he says that's very rare. That's very, very rare. Somehow you're kind of above the world of struggle. You've so internalized the virtues of goodness. And indeed, there may not be such a person as a tzaddik. A tzaddik is not somebody who simply has 51 to 49 good points. A tzaddik is someone who has transcended the world of struggle. The rasha is the person who is so far gone that struggle for the good is not an issue anymore. So according to the Bala Tanya, Beinonim are not that small group of people who are 50-50. Even the greatest tzaddikim, by and large, are definitionally beinonim, because they live in a world where they struggle with their yetzer hara in many different ways. Now, of course, the struggles of a righteous person are not going to be on the same gross level as those of a debased person. A debased person might struggle, should I eat treif or should I not eat treif? Should I steal or not steal? A righteous person, I'm not going to say tzaddik because we're using different definitions here. A righteous person is not going to be struggling, you know, should I steal that car? But there's a struggle on every level. The struggle not to be arrogant, you know, the struggle not to look down at people, you know, whatever the struggle is. So the Bala Tanya says that you can be a very, very righteous person. You could be a gadol hador, but you're still in the world of beinonim because you're living in the world of struggle. And the tzaddik, by his, he has such an atypical definition of tzaddik that essentially there basically is no such thing, almost. And therefore, Sifron Shel Beinonim was written as a guide for people who are living in the world of struggle, which is really most, you know, basically all of us are living in this world of struggle, in which we want to do the good thing, but we have impulses that sometimes lead us in the wrong direction. And how do we accommodate all of these different struggles? Now, Chabad has a legend that the Alter Rebbe wrote another treatise called Sifron Shel Tzaddikim, because you have a real question. If the tzaddik no longer lives in the world of struggle, what is the purpose of his life? Why doesn't God just take him away, so to speak? So what does it, in other words, it's like, what does a tzaddik do? You've conquered the Yetzer Hara. What does a tzaddik do? It's a mystery. So Chabad has a legend. He actually wrote a Sefer L'Tzadikim, but that Sefer got burnt. That Sefer is not available. All we have is the Sefer Shel Beinonim, which is the book that is called the Tanya. Huh? That's what he says. So these are the three names of the Sefer. Tanya is the popular name. Likutei Amorim, an anthology of sayings. And Sifron Shel Beinonim, the book of the middle of the road. Likutei Amarim. Amarim. That is the official title of the book. Just like the Rambam, by the way. You know, sometimes it's interesting that the popular title of a book is not always the author's chosen title. You know, you ask 9 out of 10 people, what is the name of the Rambam's code of Jewish law? So everybody knows. In fact, it's printed in big letters on the cover itself. Mishneh Torah, which means the repetition of the law, that was not the Rambam's title. The Rambam's title is Yad HaChazakah, the Mighty Hand, which is kind of a pun, because the Rambam's name was Moshe, and Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of the Torah is praised because of his Yad HaChazakah, the Mighty Hand. And there's another pun, because Yad is Begematria 14, and the Mishneh Torah, the Yad HaChazakah, is written in 14 books. So it's the Yad HaChazakah, the Mighty Hand of Moshe. But Yad HaChazakah is not an unknown title. A lot of people know it, but commonly we much often refer to it as the Mishneh Torah more than the Yad HaChazakah. And the same thing here, although Likutei Amorim is printed on the cover, but it is better known by the second title, Tanya, is how it's commonly known.
But yes. What's the purpose of this tzaddik if he has no struggles he almost has no choice?
Yeah,
and we God wants us to have choices, make good choices.
Well, that's an excellent
choice.
That's an excellent question. That's why we needed that. Well, not for us practically, but that's why he wrote the Book of Tzaddikim. I didn't see the book. Got burnt. I can't give you the exact answer. It seems to be that
it seems strange. Though.
Well, it seems strange, but once again, it is such a rare phenomenon that it's not. In other words. In the Bala Tanya sense, and this may sound disrespectful, but I don't think it is. In the Bala Tanya sense, we have probably never met tzaddikim. Now, certainly, I've met many, many pious Jews. I've met gedolim. I've met people who we would call great, great tzaddikim. But in the Bala Tanya's unusual definitional structure, they're not tzaddikim. Now, that's not to their discredit. It's the other way around. You could actually say, if one is struggling and they still do righteous things, that's a greater accomplishment. In other words, this is paradoxical. It could be that the Beinoni might be doing more in the world than the Tzaddik, because the Beinoni is in the world of struggle, you see? So, but in the Bala Tanya's unusual sense, it is likely that we have never met the Tzaddik that the Bala Tanya talks about.
It seems he defeats the purpose of Bacharta Betov, Tatar Tachaim Betamavatar, because he has no choice anymore.
No, but he's
conquered it. But the question is,
he spent all of his time in battle with the Yetzirah, and now has finally.
Yeah, the question becomes if you've totally accomplished your mission in life, then Hashem should take the person to Olam Haba, meaning to say. You know, as long as we're in this world, there must be something we still need to accomplish.
Like
the question becomes, what does the tzaddik need to accomplish if he's already, you know, he's accomplished it?
Could be an example, though.
It could be an example. It could be that the tzaddik's goal is to raise up everybody else. That was also a central doctrine in Chassidus, that the tzaddik raises. So, in other words, it's not the tzaddik's own avoda anymore, but he kind of raises everybody else up. But it's interesting, you know, for whatever reason, the Book of Tzaddikim was burnt, so we actually don't know the Bala Tanya's. Rabbi Steinsaltz puts it interestingly. The way he describes it is that he says, Tzaddikim on some level are born and not made. He says, the ability of a person to achieve that total victory is literally not within the realm of Bechira, meaning free will can always give me the ability to struggle and emerge victorious. But the notion of totally transcending struggle, that's a special divine gift, and that's not even within the function of the choices that I can make. God either gives it to me or doesn't, and as Steinsaltz puts it, tzaddikim were born and not made. It's kind of certain neshamas just have that capacity. There's a certain aspect of predetermination.
But this doesn't fit right with the Torah stories.
Well, it's a Kabbalistic idea.
The only objection I have is that it doesn't really fit the Torah.
Well, the Tanya is a very practical work, because the Tanya is the Sifra Shel Beinonim that's directed to all of us. So it's a very maybe that's why the Sefer Shel Tzaddikim didn't survive. That was not a work.
It really was burned.
This is what Chabad says. They have a tradition. I don't know. You know, you never know.
No historical fact.
I don't think there's any historical evidence. You know, Chabad has a lot of traditions about their rebbes, and Chabad is very meticulous. In recent years, you know. It's interesting. Chabad in recent years, since the Mashiach business, is a little different than it was in Europe. Chabad in Europe was a very rational Hasidus, which very rarely emphasized miracles. They would never talk about miracles the Rebbe did. That was not the idea. Chabad was grounded in intellectual understanding, and they would even be. They took great pride in the fact that we don't try to make our Rebbes into miracle workers, but we examined them for the content of their teachings, and they would even speak disparagingly of Polish Hasidus, which was more into miracle working.
It's supposed to be
and the like. Yeah, Chabad was a rationalist Hasidus. In recent years, it's still a philosophically grounded Hasidus, but in recent years with the Mashiach thing and other things, and with the augmentation of Chabad by many people who were not necessarily intellectual, so to speak, so there's more of a rabble-rousing, miracle-working type of aspect, which was not the case. It absolutely was not the case of Chabad in Europe. Chabad in Europe was very, very specifically very averse to all of this.
You said Chabad in Europe, till what year are you to say they were more
rabble? Till World War II. I mean, Chabad in America is a product of post-World War II. I mean, what happened was Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson came to the United States after World War II. And, you know, obviously, I mean, in many ways, you could say that this was an adaptation to America. You know, I mean, one could, again, it's a complicated phenomenon exactly what happened to Chabad. And by the way, another little bit of information that you need to know. Chabad and Lubavitch were not always synonymous. They're synonymous now, but they were not always synonymous. Let me explain a little bit what's going on. In terms of the background of Hasidus, let's go back a little bit. The so-called founder of the Hasidic movement is said to be Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. Now, Baal Shem Tov, or Besht, is a Kabbalistic title, the master of the good name. And there were Baal Shem before the Baal Shem Tov. These are people who were masters of Kabbalah, who would use different names of God to do different things, miracles and the like. So he was known as the Baal Shem Tov. And he started a movement called the Hasidim, the pious ones. And exactly what he wanted to accomplish is not entirely clear, but the general understanding of the Baal Shem Tov was he wanted to liberate Judaism from an over-reliance on legalism to the exclusion of emotion and passion, and he wanted to bring in the idea of serving Hashem with your emotions and your feelings and not just your mind. And that's why the Vilna Gaon, for example, was against Hasidus, because he thought that if Hasidus was overemphasizing emotion, they would detract from halacha and from Torah study and the like. And this was indeed, in the early years of Hasidus, this was a bit of a conflict. The Baal Shem Tov himself did not establish a mass movement. When the Baal Shem Tov died, maybe there were 100 Hasidim. There were not; it was not a major mass movement. The real creator of Hasidus as a mass movement was the successor of the Baal Shem Tov, who was Rav Dov Ber, the Mezuritcher Magid. Mezuritch was a city in Russia, and Magid was a preacher. In those days, the rabbi of a city didn't give a sermon. The rabbi only spoke twice a year, Shabbos Shuvah, before Yom Kippur, and Shabbos Hagadol before Pesach. The rabbi was not paid to give drushas. Of course, when he did speak those two times, he would sometimes speak for 4 or 5 hours, you know, kind of cover for the, but whatever it is, the Rav was not a darshan. But there was a position, either paid or an itinerant person, who was called the Magid. The Magid was a preacher. In those days, when you didn't have television or whatever it was, or internet, preaching was not just educational, but it was a form of entertainment, where the Magid would have maisim and stories, and the people who were not necessarily learned enough to understand the Rav's pilpulim could always understand the Magid's mishalim. So the Mezuritcher Magid, some of the Magidim were very great Talmidei Chachamim. The Magid of Mezuritch was a great Talmid Chacham. The Dubner Magid, who was the Vilna Gaon's good friend, was a great Talmud Chacham as well. So some Magidim were also very, very learned. Some Magidim were not necessarily learned, but they just had stories that they would tell. But they were popular. The idea of being a Magid was essentially the concept of a popular rabbi and mixing with the Rav of the community in terms of being a mixer with people in Europe. That was not the model. The Rav tended to be very aloof, learning, having a yeshiva even. The Magid was the one that was with the people. Anyway, but the Magid of Mezuritch became a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, and he was the one who really sent great disciples to different parts of Europe to spread the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. And he actually divided Europe into districts. He divided Poland, and he divided Romania and Hungary, and he literally sent Talmidim. So he sent, for example, Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhensk, the Rebbe Elimelech, to Poland, and he started Polish Chassidus, which then later kept on branching off into different groups. So the emissary, now, other students of the Maggid, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, the famous Berdichev Rebbe, he sent to the Ukraine. And the emissary who was sent to Lithuania was Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He was sent as a disciple of the Maggid of Meserich to Lithuania. Why did the Maggid of Meserich send Rav Shneur Zalman to Lithuania? Because Lithuania, Litvaks, were a highly, the Jews of Lithuania, Vilna is in Lithuania, right? Vilna, Kovna. The Jews of Lithuania were highly intellectual, highly analytical. Even to this day, you know, sometimes a Polish, a Jew from Poland, will make fun of a Litvak and call him a Kalter Litvak. Litvaks are cold. Litvaks are unemotional. Litvaks are unfeeling. They just want to sit and learn all the time. You know, they don't sing, they don't dance, etc. So the Maggid of Meserich understood, because he was really a master pedagogue, and he understood the neshamos of each of his great disciples. And he understood that the emotion and the fervor that would be appropriate for Polish Jews would not be accepted in Lithuania, which was a much more intellectual and analytical tradition. So of all of the Talmidim of the Maggid of Meserich, the one who was, number one, perhaps the greatest Talmud Chacham in terms of basic halacha and Torah, and the one that had the most philosophical understanding of Chassidus, was Rav Shneur Zalman. And that's why he was picked to be the emissary to Lithuania and starting Chabad Chassidus. In fact, it's interesting that when the Vilna Gaon excommunicated the Hasidic movement because he was afraid they were violating halacha, the emissary who was chosen to speak to the Vilna Gaon was Rav Shneur Zalman. And that he was a very good choice, because keep in mind that the Vilna Gaon had been getting reports about certain Hasidic movements who were doing somersault, in other words, like kind of drinking, mishugas. So they're not going to choose those guys to go to the Vilna Gaon. They chose a person who was a great gadol b'Torah. The Vilna Gaon refused to see him. That's true. But Rav Shneur Zalman was the closest in Chassidus to the Vilna Gaon in that. So now here's the thing. Rav Shneur Zalman came from a city, Liadi, which is a town in Russia. He became a Talmud of the Maggid of Meserich. His contemporary Chaverim were famous people. Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, you know, other. Rav Elimelech, right? These are famous Hasidic figures. All of these were his colleagues in that third generation of Hasidus. Now, what happened was this. When Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi died, and he was living in Lubavitch at the time, so that's why it became Lubavitch Hasidus. He moved from Liadi and the court of the Hasidus in Lubavitch. The issue of succession was not entirely clear, meaning to say, the Lubavitch branch, the Hasidus is called Chabad. Chabad. A Chabad is Chachma Bina Das. Wisdom, understanding, and without getting into the differences between them, the concept of Chabad was, and this is the Balatanya's argument, is that Avodas Hashem has to be rooted in intellect and understanding. It cannot be a function of passion and emotion. Interesting for a Hasidic leader to say this, because the Balatanya had a deep mistrust of unbridled emotion. Because unbridled emotion can get you all excited and stimulated, but if it's not rooted by the mind, like people get into frenzies. People get into frenzies where they murder their children or whatever they do. And therefore, the emotions in Avodas Hashem have to come from the mind down, not from the emotions up. So, of course, the Tanya is about emotions, but the emotions come from the mind. I mentioned in another shiur that this is what we say, that a melech, a king, if you take the letters of king, so melech spells moach, mind, lamed spells heart, and chaf spells kolayos, which are kidneys, which we regard as the seat of emotion, meaning a king is a person whose emotions, a king of himself, in other words, is a person whose emotions and passions are controlled by their moral and intellectual values. The opposite of melech is the word kalem. Kalem means to be destroyed. That's when the kolayos and the lev control the mind. So the purpose of Chabad Chasidus was to have the chachma controlling the emotion rather than the emotions themselves taking over. Right? This was the unique contribution of the Bala Tanya. But what happened was, you see, that the Bala Tanya established his court in Lubavitch. But after his death, there were different, he had many Talmidim. And there were different Talmidim who started variations of Chabad, and they claimed the title of Chabad. So there was Lubavitch Hasidic Chabad, and then there were non-Lubavitch Hasidic Chabads. And some of these non-Lubavitch Hasidic Chabads were actually very, very successful. There were times when Lubavitch was very small, even though Chabad Hasidus was very large. In Europe, Lubavitch Chabad was only... Now, the one thing they did have was, they did have the relatively unbroken genealogical succession from the Alter Rebbe. So you had the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman, you had Rav Shneur Zalman's son, then you had the Tzemach Tzedek, who was Rav Shneur Zalman's son-in-law, Taka, and then you have the Maharash, the Rebbe Rav Shmuel, then you have Rav Shalom Dov, the Rebbe Rashab, and then you have Rav Yo, you have seven altogether. Even the last one, Rav Nachum Mendel, was not a direct, he was not a son of the previous Rebbe, but because he was a cousin, he was descended. So there was a genealogical descent. Some of the offshoots of Chabad, some of them were other sons of the Rebbe who didn't get the Rebbeship, and others were Talmidim. But there was a very, very sizable non-Lubavitch Chabad who looked at the Alter Rebbe as their spiritual founder, but they did not necessarily acknowledge some of the other Rebbes who came after because they had their own dynasties. In fact, when Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, came to America after the war, and he founded a lot of Chabad congregations. There were Chabad congregations in the States. Many of them did not accept him as the Rebbe because he was just Lubavitch Chabad. They were connected to different Chabads. And it's actually complicated even legally because but basically what happened was by the late 1950s, all of the Chabads had agreed to accept the authority of Lubavitch as the official Chabad movements. But in Europe, it was not the case. In Europe, there was Chabad and there was Lubavitch, and they were not the same.
What was the difference?
It's not that there were significant philosophical differences, but it breaks up into different groups and different sects. There were some differences. But they were so. They were very, very subtle. There was no market. There was no obvious difference that a person would just notice from the outside. But they had machloksim in certain interpretations of Chabad philosophy. Certainly, I would say though that in recent years, we have some of that same breakaway. Actually, just in very, very recent years, as a result of the Mashiach issues, there is a fellow. I'm trying to get this book. This is one of those books that got pulled off the market, and you can't get it except for $1,000. There's a fellow, Rav Shol Shimon Deitch, who is from an old Lubavitch family, and he wrote a three-volume biography of the last Lubavitch Rebbe called Larger Than Life. And it's a fascinating, fascinating biography because he loved Lubavitch Rebbe, and he greatly admired him, but he unearthed all sorts of interesting autobiographical data, like what was the Rebbe doing in Paris when he went to the Sorbonne, and he had pictures of the Rebbe without a yarmulke, whatever. Whatever it was, like Rebbe was doing things that people do. But this was considered such a sacrilegious book that the Chabad movement took out their cannons, and somehow they managed to get every single copy totally withdrawn. The book is not.
He didn't republish it.
No, he didn't republish it. But what he did was, but a very, very fascinating book. And what he did was, though, he broke away from Lubavitch. He broke away from Lubavitch, and he calls himself a rebbe. He calls himself the Liadi Rebbe. Now, Liadi is interesting. Liadi was the original. So he considers himself a follower of Chabad Chassidus as established by Rav Shneur Zalman, but he disassociates himself from Lubavitch. So he actually started, he restarted an alternative Chabad movement.
Where? In Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn. He's in Brooklyn.
What's his name?
Deitch. Rav Shaul Deitch. I think you can get the book on Amazon, but it's one of those things that costs like $500. In other words, people who bought copies are selling it for a lot of money. But you can't get the book in a bookstore or anything. See, Chabad put out their own sanitized version of the biographies, which relied a lot. In fact, there was copyright litigation. Deutsch, I think, accused them of literally plagiarizing from his book by sanitizing the controversial parts, but taking everything else. So there was some legal action. I think they went to court about copyright infringement.
It's very dishonest.
Huh?
It's very dishonest.
Well, you know, we have the same issue with Yaakov Kamenetsky. I mean, this is a recurring issue of censorship of books about Gedolim.
That I think Orthodoxy is very.
It is a problem. People. Well, the issue is this. The issue is, do you tell truth for the sake of truth, or is there a concept that certain truths ought to be covered up because they might create a lack of respect for Torah? Say again, Dee.
How do they serve mankind if you're showing all this negative?
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is, and from my perspective, it goes back to the world of struggle, which is actually the Bala Tanya Sol thesis, to see how great people struggled with all of these different trials in their lives, I think is more inspiring than to simply create a picture that they never had any problem, you know, just were straight and narrow their whole lives. I mean, to look at what Lubavitcher Rebbe did in terms of his selflessness for 50 years, knowing that in France he was a bit of a bon vivant and he did whatever he, you know, strange things that he, unusual things that he did.
Which Rebbe did he wrote?
Rav Menachem Mendel. Not the last one, yeah. No, because the last Rebbe was educated in France. And, you know, there are stories about stuff he did in France, you know, which don't seem to correspond to the later image. But in a sense, to see that a person had struggles and had issues. And by the way, the Rebbe had brothers who were not religious, but in the official Lubavitch thing, everybody's a tzaddik and a god. And you know, it's historically documented that there were brothers in the family who were not Shomer Mitzvahs. But again, you have to understand the times, you know. This was during the communist revolution. There were thousands and thousands of Jews from religious families who were not even because they were persecuted, but they were just swept up in the movements of the time. And, you know, these are the things that happens in Poland between the wars. It is estimated that one third of the youth they became not religious. Sure. You know, so to cover that up and to make believe it was some type of golden age in which everybody was a tzaddik, I think robs us of understanding the richness of sacrifice that people made. You know, so I think that sometimes knowing this background information, as controversial as it might be, gives us a much deeper understanding of a personality.
Those people, yeah. They were tzaddikim. They may have not been in the orthodox sense tzaddikim, but they were tzaddikim in terms of what they sacrificed for a socialist revolution and their life for justice, for equality.
Well, I'll go
so
back.
They were tzaddikim.
I'll go back to the. So I'll go back to the that. To the Vilna Gaon, the teaching we had in the Vilna Gaon, in which he saw that the struggle for equality and the struggle for inclusiveness and the struggle to abolish discrimination against people is a spiritual force that is part of the process in bringing Mashiach. Now, in that sense, communism can be seen as an expression of that type of desire. Now, of course, it turned into something horrendous. Of course, it turned into something evil. As the Vilna Gaon says, when good things come into the world, the Sitra Achra, the other side, will try to pervert them and turn them into something very, very bad. But I think there's no doubt that at least from the Jewish perspective, many Jews who were motivated to be, including Jews in America who became part of the Communist Party, were largely motivated by very, very benign and really high motivations. They really thought this was a way to redress inequality. This would be a way to help poor people. This would be a way to create greater human dignity. Of course, it wasn't the case, and most American communists realized that that was wrong. I mean, there aren't that many American communists today. There aren't that many communists today at all. But as I say, these things come from good motivations in that way. So as I say, this concept that Chabad and Lubavitch are not identical has a resurgence a little bit in Liadi Hasidus and the like. Actually, I was thinking maybe I will contact Rabbi Deutsch directly and see if he would sell. You know, maybe he'll sell books out of his private stock. I don't know. But I really would like to get... I did see, it's funny, you know, it's one of those things that I saw years ago. And I didn't bother to buy because I figured, you know, I'll get it later. You know, sometimes when you see a book, you know, got to get it right away. Because things come and go and disappear and they're censored and something. So you have to get it when it's available.
Borough Park, bookstores there.
You know, I didn't look extensively, but I know that it's very hard to get, and I know that Chabad waged a tremendous amount of pressure on bookstores not to carry that book.
What's the exact title?
It's called Larger Than Life. I think it's three volumes.
Three volumes in English.
In English, in English, with many, many. The pictures are phenomenal. I mean, the where he got the pictures that he got are just very, very amazing.
The Rebbe never really. First of all, it took him a year before he accepted.
That's right.
After three years. And a lot of that, and he was, it wasn't that he was staging a coup. I mean, he was being pleaded with to accept it.
Remember, the previous Rebbe had... had actually four daughters, but as I say, some of his sons-in-law were not religious. But the oldest daughter married a Rav Gerari, Rav Shemaria Gerari, and the younger daughter married Rav Nachum Mendel Schneerson. And it was widely assumed that Rav Gerari would become the next Rebbe, but for a whole bunch of interesting reasons that are not totally clear, the younger Hasidim much more gravitated towards Rav Nachum Mendel. So it's really the younger Hasidim made him the Rebbe, and they begged with him for a year. He refused. He did not want to take the position at all. Eventually, he took the position, and he served as Rebbe for 50 years with great...
So he was more of a kind of emotions than Gerari?
You know, it is a funny thing. You know, there's an elder in Chabad who's a very almost the most respected elder, Rav Yoel Kahn. Rav Yoel Kahn, who's like now, must be in his late 80s, he's like the elder of Chabad. And according to accounts that I read, Rav Yoel Kahn almost single-handedly spearheaded the organizational structure that got Rav Menachem Mendel to be Rebbe. He was a young man, Rav Yoel Kahn, back in the 50s. And part of what comes out is the following, that Rav Gerari was a master in the philosophy of Chabad, but he didn't know that many stories about the background. He didn't know all the nigunim, so it's interesting that Rav Menachem Mendel knew all these maisim, he knew all the nigunim, etc., and therefore the young Hasidim felt they could have a more emotional connection with him. But he really didn't want the job. And not only that, but his mother-in-law, because the wife of Rav Yosef Yitzchak survived for her husband many years, his mother-in-law, it is reputed, was very, very angry that the older son-in-law didn't get the position. Now, I'll give, again, this is trivia, but it's interesting. You'll notice, if you ever see pictures of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, not the last one, he wore a shtreimel. Now, if you ever see the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the last one, wore a hat.
Why didn't he always wear a black hat.
Right. Why didn't he wear a shtreimel? So the story goes, the Rebbe is supposed to get the shtreimel of his predecessor, but his mother-in-law refused to give him the shtreimel. She says, "You don't deserve it. It belongs to the older brother-in-law." So he didn't want to insult her by getting another shtreimel, so he wore a hat. And, you know, there are many accounts of his great patience. Like, he never spoke angrily to his mother-in-law about this, but she was very, very upset. And this was a burning issue for many years. Now, Rav Gerari himself eventually became a very close chassid of the Rebbe. They remained very close friends. And Rav Gerari did not bear any enmity. But the way it works sometimes is the wives might be less forgiving, as it were. And there was a lot of rivalry. You may recall that technically, like he just died recently, Rav Gerari had, and his wife had one son, Barry. Barry left Hasidus. I believe that Barry Gerari was not Orthodox either, although I don't want to say it for sure. But technically, Barry Gerari was the closest lineal descendant. He was a nephew of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he was a grandson of the previous Rebbe. So Barry Gerari was in line for the succession. And even though he wasn't even religious, and he had no interest in it at all, but there was a movement, the pro-Gerari faction in Chabad really wanted Barry to become the Rebbe and kind of remake them. I mean, there was even this concept of, like, you know, you find some descendant of Tsar Alexander, you know, and make him Tsar of Russia, like people like to, you know, engage in those types of fantasies. Now, Barry Gerari just died, I think, maybe this, the end of 2008. He just died very, very recently. But he technically was the last Lubavitcher Rebbe via succession. Now, if you remember the story with Barry Gerari, that is, his mother Chana felt, you know, the previous Rebbe of Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson was a bibliophile. He had one of the great world collections of manuscripts and svarim. And Chana had her son take some books out of the apartment and sell them for money, for living expenses. And Lubavitcher Rebbe took the position that these svarim were not the private property of the Rebbe, which would then be divided among his heirs, half to one daughter, half to the other daughter. Rather, this was property of the movement of Chabad, and the Rebbe would have no right to sell it off. So the case was actually brought in federal district court in New York, where it was Chabad was suing the Gerari family, including Barry Gerari, for embezzlement and wrongful taking of these books, etc. And this actually went to this. Now, one could raise the whole question, what heter did Chabad have to go to a non-Jewish court? They should have gone to a Beis Din. But anyway, if you remember, you may remember this, Nat Lewin from Potomac was the attorney for Chabad. And every single day, there were like 100 Lubavitchers who would come to court to watch the proceedings. And when they won, Chabad won their case, actually. Chabad won their case. You know, there was dancing in the courtroom.
Didn't Gerari have to come to accept a bet din? Maybe because
It could be. I don't think they sent him a summons. I think they just assumed he wouldn't accept. But, you know, you have to give him the... You have to give him the chance of doing it.
So you're saying it's his sister who masterminded this? Because I just read a book about it and said that she didn't mastermind. It was her son that was the one.
I'm not sure. I don't want to say I know which one did it. But the point is that Mrs. Gerari was an old woman then. She was in her 80s then. And she was actually physically assaulted by some of the demented younger Hasidim. I mean, someone took a pipe and then hit her in the head. It was just awful, very, very awful.
So the case was... Who was
Chabad was suing for the return of the books.
They were sold already, no?
They were sold, but once again, but if they were sold by someone who didn't own the books, the
what
sale. Yeah, the sale would be null and void. I mean, if I sell your library, you can get the books back. Right? I mean, I don't own your books, so this is an interesting argument. When a Rebbe collects these rare books, and presumably he used the funds of Chabad Hasidus to buy these rare books, they're not his property. They're the property, and therefore when he dies, it doesn't go to half to one daughter, half to the other daughter. Rather, it belongs to a movement. It belongs to a movement. Just like, for example, Lahavdil, when the President of the United States gets gifts from foreign countries, he doesn't take them with him when he leaves office. You're not allowed, legally you don't take them with you, they belong to the United States. So the Rebbe, Rav Nachum Mendel, argued that these svarim are not personal things, they belong to the Lubavitch movement, and they have to remain in the Lubavitch movement.
Presidents here usually establish libraries after they finish.
Yeah, the Sabbath library. But what I'm saying is that, well, but then they have to get permission of Congress or whatever. In other words,
even to the public library.
No, because it's not the president's. I mean,
they're part of the National Archives. There's a relationship on the presidential library.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's National Archives, so that is part of the law.
So it's part of the government, yeah. Right. So even the private libraries have an arrangement with the archives. But certainly the president cannot. I mean, presidents do sometimes. We don't keep track of every single thing they ever got. But technically, any gift they get is to the office of the presidency and to the United States. It is not to the, you know, it's not to George Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. So that's a little bit of the history of Chabad. So it's a very, very interesting movement. It's because Chabad is a very intellectual movement, its history is also a bit more convoluted and complicated because they deal with complicated issues. I mean, even the lawsuits are interesting and the like. But I will say that the idea of the books that come out about all the miracles the Rebbe does, that is a relatively new phenomenon. Chabad was decidedly very anti-miracle. Chabad regarded a Rebbe not as a miracle worker. Chabad regarded a Rebbe as an expositor, as a teacher, as one who would communicate the inner meaning of the Torah and call upon you as a chassid to internalize that in your own life to become a better person. And in fact, the Bala Tanya, at the end of the Tanya, which is not part of the Tanya itself, but there are collections of letters that he wrote to different Hasidim. And he actually writes to his Hasidim, he doesn't want to be bothered with people asking for brachas for money. Because people will go to a Rebbe and say, I need a parnasa, give me a bracha. He says, that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to help you earn money or whatever it is. I'm here to help you spiritually in Torah and mitzvos. He says, don't waste my time coming for this money problem and that money problem. Because he saw that as a secondary function, and it was almost a denigration of what a Rebbe is supposed to be. In fact, the old Lubavitchers tell the following story. They were a bunch of Hasidim were standing around, and each one was talking about why their Rebbe was the best Rebbe. So one person said, my Rebbe is the best Rebbe because I came to him and I asked him for a bracha on business, and he gave me a bracha on business, and I made $1 million, or whatever, a million rubles. So he's wonderful. And another person says, my wife and I were married for 20 years and we didn't have children, and we went to the Rebbe, and 9 months later, you know, we had twins. And the other one says, my mother was ill and lying on her deathbed, and none of the doctors could help, and this Rebbe gave her a bracha, and she became better. So my Rebbe could be Rofei Cholim. So finally, the Lubavitcher said, well, I went to my Rebbe for a business deal, and he gave me some advice, and I lost all my money, and I went bankrupt. And that was the end of the story. So they said, they didn't really know what to do with it. They said, so what's the point of the story? He says, the point of the story is that he's still my Rebbe, even though I lost money on it. Meaning to say, I don't go to him because he helps me make money. I don't go to him because, you know, he cures my illnesses. I don't go to him because he gives me kids. I go to him because he teaches me how to serve Hashem. And therefore, even if those other things don't happen, he's my Rebbe because of what he teaches me. And that was actually what Chabad was. That was what Chabad always was. It wasn't that the Rebbe did something for you other than teaching you how to serve Hashem in a proper way. That's very significant because in some other early manifestations of Hasidus, to some degree, the relationship with the Rebbe kind of absolved you of doing mitzvahs yourself. Like the Rebbe will do everything and he will carry you. And here, it's very much the opposite, in which the being a chassid involved a tremendous responsibility. It did not mean the Rebbe carried you. It meant one had to work. Now, to that degree, that's still true with Chabad. I mean, to that very day. If you look, for example, it is a remarkable movement in so many ways. If you look at the shaluchim who go to every place in the world, I mean, that's the old saying, that there are two things you can find everywhere in the world, Coca-Cola and Chabad. And that's more or less true. These are people who are very, very devoted, amazingly devoted. I mean, people who go to faraway countries, people who establish schools, whether you agree with everything they do or not. The Mesiras Nefesh is without any question a tremendous, tremendous Mesiras Nefesh. And this comes from the idea that being a chassid is a responsibility. It is not simply having the Rebbe lift you up in that particular way. Okay, so anyway, that's just kind of by way of introduction. So Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi is called the Alter Rebbe, the Old Rebbe, because he was the first of Chabad. Now again, in Chassidus, he is the third generation, because you have the Baal Shem Tov, and you have the Magid of Mezerich, Rav Dov Ber. So those are kind of the precursors, as Chabad puts it. Chabad kind of looks at that as kind of the precursors to the real Chassidus, which is Chabad. And then Rav Shneur Zalman is called the Alter Rebbe, the first of the Rebbes. By the way, he was also very involved in politics. He was very involved in establishing communities of Chassidim in Eretz Yisrael at the time when the Vilna Gaon's Talmidim were going to Eretz Yisrael. He was very involved in that. He was very involved in, and this is a controversial political decision, this was during the Napoleonic Wars with Russia. And the Jews were debating, did they want Napoleon to win? Because remember, under Tsar Alexander, they were oppressed. It was awful. And Napoleon promised emancipation and civil rights. But Rav Shneur Zalman sided with the Tsar. And he actually raised money for the Tsar, because he felt that spiritually the Jews would be more endangered with freedom than they were in servitude. And indeed, this was the case, because Jewish emancipation actually spurred the reform movement and other things like that, because once Jews are freed from the ghetto, they could go anywhere. In the ghetto, you know, if you were a smart, intelligent person and you couldn't go to college, so you'd put your energies in Torah study. He actually felt that the Jews, again, it was a controversial decision, but he felt that Jews were better served by oppression than by liberty. This was his position at the time. He actually got a medal from the Tsar. He became, whatever it is, a friend of the Tsar, which came to haunt the Schneerson family in 1917 when the communists accused the Schneerson family of being counter-revolutionary because they were officially recognized by the Tsar for their contributions. So it actually came back to haunt them later. Now, just to give you a little, just to take the dynasty down, as I indicated, Rav Shneur Zalman had a few sons. In fact, one of the sons, there are some rumors he converted to Christianity, but again, there's a lot of dark history here. But one of his sons did become his successor for a short time, Rav Dov Ber, and that was a son that he named after his own Rebbe, Rav Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezerich. And Chabad calls this Rav Dov Ber, they call him the Mittler Rebbe, the middle Rebbe, because he was really a very, very short duration. And he's between the Alter Rebbe, who's number one, and the third one, who was a Rebbe for a very long time. So the Mittler Rebbe was a short middle period. The third Rebbe was a son-in-law of the Mittler Rebbe, but he was a direct grandson of the Alter Rebbe, because people married cousins. And this is his name was also Rav Menachem Mendel, the same name as the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he was called the Tzemach Tzedek, because Tzemach Tzedek means the outgrowth of righteousness. That was the name of his many svarim. The Tzemach Tzedek, huh?
Just like Rashi.
Right, right, right. The Tzemach Tzedek was a remarkable leader. He was Chabad Rebbe for over 30 years. He greatly expanded the movement. He was one of the Gedolei Hador in Psak Halacha. He was accepted by Hasidim and non-Hasidim alike. He wrote many, many Svarim in Shas, in Kabbalah, in Halacha. You know, basically a real, real master of all parts of the Torah, a tremendous organizer, charismatic figure. Tzemach Tzedek, that probably was Chabad at its height in Europe. And the Tzemach Tzedek had many sons, some of which started rival Chabad sects. But the Lubavitch successor to the Tzemach Tzedek was the Rebbe known as Maharash, which is the Moreno Harav Shmuel. And he was also a Rebbe only for a very short time. And interesting, now the Maharash is what? The fourth Rebbe. Now it's interesting, the fourth Rebbe is the only Rebbe of Chabad of whom we have absolutely no photograph. No photograph and no picture. We have a drawing of the Alter Rebbe, the Mittler Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, and all the ones that came after. No picture of Maharash. Again, there's all sorts of legends and speculation. Some say Maharash was very heavy and didn't look like a Rebbe, so they don't want to put a picture of him. Some say the Maharash was very, very sick and almost disfigured because of his health. Who knows? Recently, somebody produced a picture of the Maharash that looks exactly like the sixth Rebbe, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, but it looks so much like Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson that it's almost impossible to believe. it's like you're looking, you know, they say, well, he looked just like, you know, his grandson, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, but, you know, most people feel that that is Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, and it's not the Maharash. It is said that in the 770 archives, there are pictures of Maharash, but those pictures are not made available. Moreno Harav Shmuel, the Rebbe Reb Shmuel. Now, again, perhaps because the Maharash had certain negatives associated with him, so to compensate, Chabad built legends that he was the greatest of all the Rebbes, etc. Whatever it is, in other words, sometimes there are things said about him that aren't even said about the other Rebbes because of that. But the Maharash is a Rebbe that is a bit mysterious. We don't have a lot of writing from him. He was not a Rebbe for very long. We don't have a picture of him. Some even say, you know, the cynics say, that the Tzemach Tzedek had greater sons than him, but he felt that the Maharash needed the position of Rebbe, because that's the only way he would make a living, whatever it is. You know, I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't even say that because I can't. None of this is first-hand knowledge. What I'm saying is that in Chabad, there's a lot of different things that people talk about and people don't know necessarily. Now, Maharash, again, had many children, but the child who became the next Rebbe is called the Rebbe Rashab. Rashab is Rav Shalom Bear. Bear is the same as Dov. Bear in Yiddish. And the Rebbe Rashab is given the title the Moreh Nevuchim of Chassidus. Moreh Nevuchim is the Rambam's book, Guide to the Perplexed, because the Rashab was a very, very philosophical thinker.
Where did he come? I'm sorry, which Rebbe is here? He's after?
He's after Maharash. He's the fifth. The Rebbe Rashab. And we're still in Lubavitch. The Rebbe Rashab started the great Lubavitch yeshiva in Europe, Tomchei Tumimim. He was the founder of a great yeshiva. The Rebbe Rashab was a very profound philosophical person. He was also a very kind person in terms of looking after the welfare, because he started a yeshiva, so he was very involved in youth. Now remember, that was a big deal then, because remember that Orthodoxy generally was losing adolescents and young adults very, very rapidly because of communism, because of Zionism, because of nationalism, because of all the different movements, because of basically the reform movement, because of the emancipation of the Jews. So he spent a lot of his energies in working with young people, but he was also a very profound thinker. Now here's something that's very, very interesting. He was Rebbe for a long time and a very, very capable, both in terms of learning and in terms of connection to people, and in terms of organizational ability. He was even as a manager, a very, very competent and skilled manager. Now, here's something I just read recently. Someone sent me an article. That is, Chabad talk about the fact that there was a period during his Rebbeship in which he became ill, and he had to go to Vienna to see special doctors. Okay, they say for 2 years he went to Vienna to see special doctors. So lo and behold, someone sends me an article which is very well researched that actually proves that the special doctors that he saw was none other than Dr. Sigmund Freud. And that Rav Shalom Dov did suffer from what was called melancholy or depression. And he wanted to see Sigmund Freud to discuss this, which is very, very interesting. Sigmund Freud, of course, is Jewish, and Freud's Jewish background is still debated. And this author, this is a professor at GW, or at Georgetown, actually produced records. I don't remember where he got them from. Records in which the Rebbe described his conversations with Freud. And, you know, they kind of met as equals. It wasn't like, although the Rebbe was going to Freud as one would go to a psychiatrist, a therapist, but they essentially talked as equals regarding the human personality, what motivates a person, what are their urges. And the Rebbe was perfectly able. I mean, the Rebbe had thought about these matters through the prism of Torah for 30 years. And he certainly understood the psychology of the soul and what drives a person. And they had long discussions. So it wasn't so much that Freud was treating him, but, you know, he talked to Freud about these issues. And it is said that he incorporated, you know, some insights that he thought were useful in his work as Rebbe. And the remarkable thing, though, about this, and again, you might say, well, isn't it so shameful to reveal the fact that one of the great tzaddikim suffered from depression and went to the non-religious Freud? But, you know, if anything, this increases admiration very, very much. Because, first of all, keep in mind that in spite of the fact that obviously this Rebbe had issues with depression, look at all he was able to accomplish, in spite of the fact that he wasn't feeling so great all the time. But, you know, the years and the yeshivas and the talmidim and the chizuk that he gave, and he didn't allow that depression to drag him down, in spite of whatever it was he was feeling. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement. The fact that he was humble enough to seek help, even from someone who spiritually, you know, was not where he was. So you can look at this as something you want to cover up because it's embarrassing. But I think it's really quite remarkable, and it's really just the Rebbe Rashab. But this is something that came out very, very recently. In other words, Lubavitch just always writes in the biographies, he went to Vienna, Lidrosh Barofim. He went to Vienna to see doctors, because Vienna was a major medical center. Actually, it was to see Sigmund Freud to work on therapy. And even it is said, Freud gave him some, it's almost non-Freudian advice, it's almost common sense advice. Freud told him, you got to take walks every day, you have to have times of the day when people don't see you, kind of just normal practical advice. And it is said that the Rebbe incorporated that. The Rebbe would take walks every day, he would have times when, you know, an hour or two a day when nobody could see him, etc. So Freud, I guess Freud realized that with the Rashab, you really can't give him Freudian advice. That's not going to work so much. So Freud just reverted to being a physician and telling him, you know, what to do to preserve his health. Because I think he realized that in terms of psychology of the soul, he was dealing with someone who had a more profound understanding of the soul. Now, the Rebbe Rashab only had one child, unlike the other Rebbes who were more fertile. And that one child was Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. And Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson was the Rebbe who came to the United States after World War II and moved Lubavitch to the United States. Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, in turn, had no sons. He did have some daughters, and two of the daughters I indicated, one married Rav Gerari, and the other married Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, same last name, you see, because people married cousins. So the Schneerson is the family name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, simply because the first Rebbe was Schneer Zalman, Schneer son of Schneer, right? So even though... Huh? It is spelled differently, that's correct.
Does Schneer have a meaning?
Well, Schneer is a Hebrew name. Now, there is a story about that, too. Some say that Schneor comes from Schneor, two ors. Because what do they say? They tell the story.
Double light.
But they say that it actually came for this reason. A boy was born, and he had two grandparents. His maternal grandfather was Meir, light, and his paternal grandfather was Uri. So how do you name the kid? Do you name him Meir or Uri? Meir Uri. So they say, the story goes, they invented the name Schneur, two lights to pick up the mayor and the Uri. That's the story. I don't know if it's true. But Schneer is it's not such a common name, but it is a name. Interesting, I haven't come across, you know, if you look at Lubavitch names, you know, there are plenty of many Menachem Mendels, many Yosef Yitzchaks. I have not come across too many people named after the Alter Rebbe. I'm not aware of too many Schneer Zalmans for some reason. It's not such a common name.
Of course, there's Zalman Schneer.
Do you know a lot of Schneer Zalmans?
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't. I made more Menachem Mendels than Schneer Zalmans in that sense.
Which are the common, you say, Menachem?
No, Menachem Mendel is very, very common. Yosef Yitzchak is very common. Shalom Dov is common. Basically, they name after their rebbeim, as it were. But they do spell it differently because one is S-O-N, one is S-O-H-N. I don't remember which one it is. But that's why Rav Menachem Mendel has the same last name, because although he was a son-in-law, but he was descended from Schneerson.
Mendel's father was a descendant from the Tzemach Tzedek.
Tzemach Tzedek. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct.
He picked up the name, but he also was.
That's correct.
He's descended from the only other Rebbe in Chabad that was not a direct descendant of Schneer Zalman.
That's correct. That's right. That's correct, because the Tzemach Tzedek was a son-in-law, just like as Menachem Mendel is a direct descendant of the Tzemach Tzedek, and he's also a son-in-law. That's correct. Interestingly enough, the Rav Menachem Mendel grew up very far from Lubavitch. He grew up in the Ukraine, and his father did not send him to the Lubavitch Yeshiva to learn. And there were some issues why his father did not send him to the Lubavitch Yeshiva to learn. And part of the story is that he wanted his son to kind of be independent, to kind of develop a philosophy that wouldn't just be the party line, because he had a vision that his son would be a leader, and as a result, shouldn't be indoctrinated by the conventional wisdom, but should develop a certain independence of approach. But he never sent his son. His son, Rav Nachum Mendel, did not learn in the Lubavitch Yeshiva.
But he learned in Yeshiva.
He didn't really learn in Yeshiva at all. He really kind of learned with his father, and then he learned by himself. Lubavitch Rebbe is not a product of any Yeshiva. That I know of.
And secular, they did.
Well, secular, the story goes, he went to the Sorbonne. He went to Paris. I don't know if he has, I don't think he has a PhD. They make up some stories. He doesn't have a PhD, but he did take engineering courses in the Sorbonne. And when he came to Brooklyn after World War II, he worked in Brooklyn Navy Yard. So what happened was he would work in Brooklyn Navy Yard 9 to 5. Then he would help his father-in-law organize Lubavitch. He did. He had quite a career in Lubavitch before he became Rebbe. You know, he was Rebbe for so long, but before he became Rebbe, he published a lot of books for Chabad. In other words, not that he wrote the books, but he would like edit. He would edit the books of the old Rebbeim. He would annotate them. He would prepare indexes. He did quite a lot of publishing. He did many things before he became Rebbe. And
Hayom Yom, all of us,
he did many, many projects. In fact, to some degree, that's why he became so popular among Hasidim, because he was involved in all of those different things.
I remember Lubavitch was arguing not to go to college, so we told him about Rebbe. He says, the Rebbe went down to Mem Tes Taras, Shalei Tuma, in order to bring up all those people.
Right, right, right.
But
right.
You have no chance to go down.
You'll go down, not go up.
So I said, okay. Right, let me take a taste of it.
Okay, we'll stop here, but the Mem Shishim will get a little started.